Ready, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Thank you for coming to be interviewed. The stories collected will be shared most especially with Aleut community members of our community. And our voices will be collected and the stories will be archived so that the children, grandchildren, future kids, they have our voices if they are going to write any stories or tell any stories in the future. This is from us, Unungan, here on the island and not someone else. So let's start with telling about who you are, your biography. My name is Aquilina Lestenkoff. My middle name is Debbie. I am 63 years old, and I was born on St. George Island. I had six brothers and two sisters. I was the second to the youngest in my range of siblings. I have three grandchildren, one on the way, number four. And my middle name, Debbie, I got that before I was born. My siblings, apparently they were telling my mom that she was going to have Debbie. And so that ended up being my middle name after I was born. My first name, Aquilina, I got that name because I was born on St. Aquilina's Day. And my dad, it was a deacon at the time in the Orthodox Church, and he heard I was born during the church service, and so he named me Aquilina. Describe growing up. Describe your childhood to your teens. Talk about responsibilities you had, or mealtime, or toys, or friends, anything about your childhood that you'd like to share. Okay. I grew up most of my childhood on St. Paul Island. I lived on St. George Island until I was four. And my dad was moved over here by the church to serve the Orthodox Christians here on St. Paul Island. So we came over by ship, and that's when my whole family ended up here and we started living here. A lot of my responsibilities or anything in my family really revolved around my dad being a priest and my mom being a matushka. Growing up pretty much almost under the steeple of the Saints Peter and Paul Church in the priest house. I remember meal times, being when we all sat together around the table. And I remember lunch times more than I remember dinner times. And I think it has to do with my brothers coming home from working in the pelt processing plant. And I remember how their clothes smelled of salt water and fur seal pelts, brine, and that my mom didn't allow them to sit on the furniture in the living room. And we would all sit down, share a meal, and maybe for the last few minutes before they had to head back to work after lunch, they would go and lay on the floor in the living room. They might play a record, some music, and it seems like that was a time for them to tickle me or make me laugh or play with me as a four-year-old, five-year-old, six-year-old. So the earlier times of being 4 years old up to being 9 years old are vague to me. There's like memories here and there, but not too many of them. But I was 9 years old and one of my brothers drowned. And when he drowned, it was kind of an eye-opener and a time in my life where I felt like I became aware, more aware of things around me than I was before that, where it was just all fun and things were taken care of for you and as a child. And my brother drowning, I was in a home with parents that cried, and I felt their loss of my brother. And I felt it too. I felt it differently than them. There was almost a sense of not knowing how to approach it, not knowing how to react to it, but seeing my parents' example, their heartache, affected my life for the rest of my life, really. When I got to be about 8, 9, 10, and wandering a little bit further from just playing around by the house, wandering away on my own, the friends that I had at the time were Carol and Barbara Swetsoff, were my closest friends. They also moved over from St. George Island, the Swetsoff family, and we played out all the time. Well, we played out as much as we could. We could not play out on Saturday evenings during church. Sunday mornings, there was church. We couldn't play out Saturday evenings after church. Pretty much stayed home. And that's where my life still evolved, around the church. There were no telephones. So it's not like you could call up your friend's house and see if they were home or to hook up with them. You had to go and to their door and knock and say, "Is Carol home? Is Barbara home? Can they play out?" And I remember one time going to pick them up. I think we would take turns as well. Like, I would, the day before, I might say, "Tomorrow I'll come and pick you up, okay?" And then the next day it'll be your turn. So you had made those plans of who was going to pick up who, and about what time. And sometimes there were chores, there were things to be done in the morning, but there might be times in the mornings we would pick each other up and head out. But I feel like most of the time it was in the afternoons after lunch. And one time I went to pick up Carol and Barbara, and I knocked on the door, and they were still having lunch. So their mom let me in, and there was this garbage can in the corner of the kitchen that I sat on while they were in the dining room having to finish their meal. So for me, there was an expectation, when I look back on it, that the family, that's the time the family is together and you had to finish your meal. And most of us wanted to finish our main meals because it's not like there was a restaurant to go to later, or wouldn't necessarily be given a bunch of snacks and you're playing outside. So when we went out, we might play kickball. The playground that we went to was located just right outside this Civic Center building, actually. It was the school. The school was located here, so the playground was on the west side of this building. And there was a swing set. There was a really high slide. I feel like slides got lower because of fear factors of kids getting hurt. But this, yeah, this one was really high. There was a merry-go-round, and you don't hardly see merry-go-rounds and playgrounds anymore. There was this playground or equipment called a tingling. And the tingling was a pole, and kind of like this, it was a pole, and at the top of the pole sat a metal cap with chains off of it, and the chains connected down to rings at the bottom, so kind of like a bell shape. And you hung on to the ring at the bottom, and you swung it around that pole. So if you were on one side of it, sometimes you're way up in the air swinging around, and when you came down by the pole, you pushed it into the pole so those other folks on the other side swung around, and sometimes you'd fly off that thing. But it was so much fun. There were two poles for tetherball, and tetherball, you'd have kids in line, somebody wrapped that ball on a rope around the pole, they won. You couldn't stop them, so the next person would come in, rotate in. There was a four square, which is a cement pad with four squares on it, and four people might be bouncing a ball. You had to try to bounce a ball in to the other player's square and try to do it in such a way they couldn't hit it back to you. If you got your ball on a line, then you were out. If you couldn't hit the ball back to another square, you were out. And we had players rotating in of all ages. So there were older kids then being 13 years old or 14, because we didn't have school beyond 8th grade then. And so you might be 6 years old and challenging a 13-year-old, and some were nice, some weren't. The school did not have a gymnasium, so when we were going to have physical ed, PE time, we had our tennis shoes for gym hanging around our seats on our desks, and when they said it was time for PE at the rec hall, everybody grabbed their gym shoes and walked over to the rec hall, and you might have some running laps, maybe played volleyball, dodgeball. The rec hall was the gymnasium for the school. I also hung out with Anna and Helen Pletnikoff. There was Marfa and Gina, Virginia Rukavishnikov, and Daria Dirks, Marfa Titov. We had sizable groups of kids per grade. And the times that I grew up in were the 1960s. My brother drowned in 1969, so those earlier years in the 60s are not as clear to me as in the 70s, from the time that I was 10 years old on up. Sizable groups of kids or of classes in the school, but not beyond 8th grade. In my preteen and teen years, they had two movie theaters here. There was the Seabreeze Theater, and then there was Irish's Theater, although we just called them Top Show and Bottom Show. Like, what's playing at the Top Show? What's playing at Bottom Show? Just because one was up here in the town on the hill and the other one was lower. And those theaters, I don't know when they started, but they were in existence in the 60s and into the 70s and they started to fade out, and I believe in the mid-70s, possibly, with the arrival of television, people didn't need to, like, pay to go view something on a screen once television started here. But that was fun. In the Seabreeze Theater, it was run by John and Mary Cushion. And my great aunt, we called her Popcorn Grandma, Marina Kozloff. She would walk up from their house, which was house number 3. And she had a scarf on and her coat and walk up the hill and up to the Seabreeze Theater to make popcorn. So when you went into the theater, there was an actual booth. You went up and you paid to go in, and you went into the theater and you could buy popcorn in the back, and they had theater seating where the back was higher and it went down to the bottom. And those of us that were children viewers, there were benches up in front that we would sit at. And that was something we could get to do, and most every night. I don't think it was on the weekends, not on Saturdays. I'm not sure if they were on Sunday nights. And I remember playing Cowboys and Indians after you saw Western movies about the West, John Wayne, or those types of shows, and it was fun to pretend you're riding on horses and making sounds, running down the hills and having bow and arrows or guns and firing at each other. The cool thing as well was where Seabreeze Theater was, when you came out, I remember it would be just like, it was really dark in there, it would be bright and your eyes adjust to the outdoors. And the playground was right outside the theater door, so play around in the playground for a bit, run off the sitting down in the theater. That was a lot of fun. As a kid, my friends and I would also go hang out around the fur seal, the seal plant, and there were a row of buildings just by the grocery store, and you walk, you go in there, and sometimes you got asked to leave, but other times, I think their dad worked there. I think Carol and Barbara's dad worked in there in the summer times. And their older brothers worked in there as well. But we would go and watch fur seal pelts being fleshed on blubber beams by fleshing knives. And we were always curious about other people from here. My brother would be there fleshing. Their older brother, Didor, would also be there fleshing pelts. But they brought in folks from other places, and some of the people's names I remember being 10, 11 years old or so was Charlie Beaver, Miles Cleveland. There was Byron George, I think. Just, I don't know why these names stick out to me. Part of me thinks it's because they might have been classmates in Chemawa or Mount Etchcombe with older teenage boys here, and so I might see them here, but I would remember the name because we also had yearbooks from those schools, and I would go, oh yeah, that person was here, that person was here. So you kind of remember their names even after they've only been here one summer. And through my growing years, my parents had the Chemawa and Mount Etchcombe yearbooks in the living room, and those were our go-tos We didn't have television, so you're looking at pictures, you're looking at your older siblings' yearbooks. So first-seal pelt processing was going on in the 70s, in the times that I was growing up. You'd also go into the brine shop. The brine shop was where pelts were taken and placed in these pelts that have been already fleshed were taken, and they were put through these runners that kind of squeegeed the excess water, dirt, or salt off of them, and then they were put in these huge tanks. So someone was throwing these skins into the tanks, and someone else is on the top pushing them down with a long pole to make sure that they go down into the tank. And I feel like there was like a paddle wheel that maybe moved the tanks through to kind of swish them to clean off the excess, anything that needs to be cleaned off. And in that tank was a solution of salt to water. A brine, and they had a specific recipe for how it was made. And then they would like put these racks over them to weigh them down and hold them under in the brine for a bit. And then folks the next day came and they pulled them out, and they were taken over into another building. And the racks that they were on were slanted so any excess water or whatever could run off them. Then they would be taken there would be another whole group of people that were taking and preparing these pelts, rolling them up and putting them in barrels to be shipped out. When I think in my teen years, early teens, maybe even before I was a teenager, we would go down, and in the summertime, the summertime activity was to go down to the beach and wade in the water. And my parents, with my brother drowning, sometimes it was very hard for them to say yes to me to go play in the sea. And it was very tough for me to ask them, can I go wading? Because I felt like they would say no. But there are times they said yes, and it's not something we ever did on our own. Usually everybody went. We see that happening now, where someone is going to go and wade and hang out down in the beach. Other folks go as well. The interesting thing, and the one thing that was different when I was growing up, is right past the National Marine Fisheries staff quarters was a big byproducts plant. And that byproducts plant, they processed carcasses from the seal harvest. And this involved hanging them on hooks, and they went on a conveyor belt before they went into another area for them to start processing them to make meal for mink food, I believe. Maybe other things too, but mink food. And below this conveyor belt were cement trough, so that the blood would drip off of these carcasses. So they're basically bleeding them, trying to get as much blood off of it as possible. And then those troughs, some water would be running through it, and it would put it out into the channel past the salt lagoon. And so that bloody water is coming where we would be wading and playing as kids. So you'd see like this stream of seal blood going through. Maybe it was like good for our skin. I don't know. So you just grow accustomed to the scent of seal. I think the interesting thing for me right now is that I was walking home the other day, and I feel the effect of the lack of tax dollars in our community from processing crab. But I was thinking, I don't miss the smell of cooking crab. I do not like that smell. I would rather smell a bloody raw seal over the smell of cooking crab any day. Like, yeah. And I don't know if it's because that's what I grew up with. I don't know what children now who think they didn't mind smelling the crab because they grew accustomed to it. Who knows? In the winter times, some of the things we did as kids was going sledding, skating, making tunnels in snow. It seemed like there was so much more snow back in the, at least my times with the late 60s into the 70s. And your kids, you play, you're not quite given the chore of shoveling snow quite yet. There was the houses where Carol Mell lives, the houses beyond that, house 125, 124, 126, the snow would come up by those houses on the east side of them and build up into these really nice nice high piles of snow that almost went to the edge of their roof, the roofs, the lower end of the roofs. So you just tunnel in and just spend time just tunneling in and making it come out in another area, and a bunch of snow back then. There's not as much now. Just playing in snow, trying to make an igloo, trying to cut out like little squares and pile them up on each other. And I don't remember like when we started to have first snowfalls that stayed and how long they stayed. I just remember that when it happened, you're out and playing in it as much as possible, digging tunnels and going in the storms and still going and picking up your friends and running through drifts. And there wasn't a school gym yet. It's not like in the evenings there was some place for kids to go and hang out, some indoor space. But I don't know, we may do. I don't remember ever being bored. We might visit each other. If there were times that I visited Carol and Barbara, or even Helen and Anna, basements were the place for us to play. Carol's and Barbara's, if we played in their basement, it was also a place where their mom hung laundry. And I remember her having curtains hanging in the basement to dry, and somehow they became a stage, or like we could go behind the curtains and it's another room. And or we might take them down, I don't know if we were supposed or not, and wrap them around us like these fancy dress of the Roman era. And whatever we saw in the movie theaters, that's what we might reenact with our play. The cool thing is their mom, Justina, wasn't very tall. She had nice little feet, so it was fun wearing her high heel shoes. They weren't like really huge, like size 9 or anything like that, so we had fun trying on her high heel shoes. My mom's feet were longer. It didn't feel any fun when I went home and tried to wear my mom's shoes. My growing up times from moving from St. George to here were in the priest house that burned down a few years back. And that house had a basement as well. And the one thing I remember about that basement is the door was really heavy, a big wooden door that was handmade locally, I'm sure. You opened it up to go up steps to exit the exterior of the house, but you could also come from within the house down the stairs. And at the bottom of the stairs, there was a dartboard, mostly for my brothers, but I'd play with it as well. And that door had a whole lot of holes in it from boys throwing darts at it for a long period of time. Then under the stairs, there was the laundry area, and there was a window that was facing the church, and my brothers would play music there into the late 60s, early 70s, and when they played music there, the window would be open, and there'd be kids hanging out, like checking out these teenage boys playing music, their guitars and drums, and I would wait till everybody left, and I'd go downstairs and play the drums myself. My dad did take a picture of me playing the drums. I don't know. I was probably maybe 9 or 10, and I had rollers in my hair, sitting there with cat-eye glasses, and rollers in my hair. So, yeah, that into the early 70s, I lived in the priest house, and that priest house was there and owned by the church. And probably, gosh, when was it? That it was in 1999, I think, that it burnt down. So, quite a few years there. Let's see. In the 80s, the 80s were the times when I was married and raising kids, at least the first part of the 80s. And I think there were a lot of things that changed here in the 80s. Or there was, I don't know if change is the right word. I don't know. If almost like an invasion, there was this end of the fur seal industry, the commercial fur seal industry that took place in the early 80s. And as it was happening, commercial fisheries was developing. So there was like excitement, and it felt like people were really concerned. The leaders at the time, I was in my early 20s, and looking back, I kind of wish I paid more attention to what was going on. But at the same time, when you're raising kids, your focus is different. And when you're young raising kids, your focus is really different. I was married to Thomas Bordakovsky. And he did some commercial fishing, but I didn't have that. He didn't own a boat, so at that time there was just a handful of. I think there's only three boats that were owned by commercial fishermen, and this was the Cleopatra. And I don't know if they're co-owned, but I link the Cleopatra to Larry Merkulyev and Ernest Stepitin, and then the Bombay Lady to Max, my brother Max Lestinkoff, and then there was the Amethyst, and the Amethyst was Simeon and maybe Dieter. I don't know if Simeon's the one that owned it, and Dieter, his brother, fished with him. So you had my brother Max, my brother Philip, probably Philip Lestinkoff, fished with him. And so everyone was learning something, this trade of commercial halibut fishing. So you see the end of this fur seal era, and it's it was very concerning when it was ending. Financially, will the community survive? But at the same time, there was this excitement with developing the halibut fishery. And will it happen? Will it be successful? And do we develop our own processing plant, which happened? Do we market ourselves? So you have, yeah, there was, I'm sure, a lot of excitement by the young leaders of that time in figuring out how all of that worked. I didn't have too much hands-on involvement in any of those changes in per se. In the 80s, I was working in the school as a school community librarian, and spent the 80s working school months for the school district in the school, and up into the 90s, while my kids were also going to school. And even then, but when I was going to school into the 70s, there wasn't a local school district. It was managed by the state-operated schools. You'd see SOS stamped on furniture and things like that. And when the Pribilof School District was formed, you might still have some of that old furniture, but there was a lot of new happening, a new school. The old school was no longer used, and in the early 70s, the school we have now was built, and I think 1972, 73, or 73, 74 was the first year that it was used. So then you're getting, yeah, and putting in a beyond an eighth grade program. It didn't happen until, I think, the early 90s. No, I take that back. There was ninth and tenth grade available to youth on St. George and St. Paul in those early years, 73, 74, 75, and it wasn't until later that they put in a full high school. So let's see. I think if I were to think back about my own years of going to school, there would be many elders living today that would remember the same teachers. For example, Joe and Joanne Widman, Mr. and Mrs. Widman. There are people that remember them as teachers. People remember them here in those times of change, from where there was this wall between Native people and non-Native people, and people that were non-Native that were working here managing the fur seal fisheries. They might place rules on teachers coming in, saying not to mix and mingle with them. The Widmans were teachers that kind of shook their head about that, and they had somebody here from the community minding their kids, their little ones, while they were teaching in school, and they invited women over for tea, Joanne Wood, and it spanned over a long period of time from the old school into the new school in the 70s, where they came back and taught again. So it was, I don't know if they were like my favorite teachers. Some folks might remember Joe Widman as somebody who was really strict. He was a principal, and yeah, there was punishment of, he had a whistle with hung around his neck, and sometimes he'd pull that off and he would slap your hand, or there was demerits, or a ruler. If you had demerits, you might get a spank on the hand with a ruler. Let's see. This time of year, this is January, winter time, I think back to in the 70s, my impressionable times, where Muscaraton was, I'm sure it was so much fun in a different way for people before me, but I really wanted to try being a Muscarata when I was probably 9 or so. And again, this is like that, as I mentioned, my brother drowned, and all the feelings that that evoke. I don't know. I feel like it's a contributing factor. I'm like, want to try different things, but I understood that children are not doing Muscaraton, that was like reserved for adults. I didn't understand why at the time, but I like wanted to go. So my brother Timon was married to Hetty Mendrigan Mustenkoff at the time, and they liked to play. When you were going to go Muscaraton, people would say to each other, "Are you going to play? You going to play?" And I wanted to play. And I had to ask my parents, and they said okay. So I went, and Timon and Hetty were getting ready, and they might be sewing costumes or pinning different clothes together or cutting up old clothes and creating different things. And I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So they dressed me up in ragged clothes, made me a stick with a bandana or a handkerchief on the end that they stuffed, and I was to be a hobo. And so I remember going in the bathroom, and Hetty or Team and one of them putting Desidin. It's Desidin is diaper rash cream. So Desidin, the smell of it right now, it still sticks in my head. They use that to make your face white because they didn't have like costume makeup for on stage stuff, so Desidin worked. And gave me like stubble and big red lips and big eyebrows and a hat, and they would be laughing and looking at me. I could hear Hetty's laugh right now. She looks at the change in my face by putting makeup on it. And then they're like, "Okay, go sit down and wait for us to get ready." So like sitting and waiting, because I now have to, I'm like excited and scared at the same time. And I remember picking up some comics and looking at them, and then I hear them laughing, and they're putting on their own makeup in the bathroom, and I'm in the kitchen, and they're peeking out at me. And if I recall correctly, I'm like reading a funny comic book, but the face they gave me was like this sad face, so to them it looked funny. I'm like reading a funny comic and had a really sad makeup face. And when they're ready, then we get, and I think there are other people that came and joined them as well, and we all walk up to the rec hall, and there's the community members, community's all sitting around, everybody's excited to see who's coming and what they're dressed as, and I'm walking with my hobo stick, and I was hooked. I liked that feeling of a little bit of fear and going in to this unknown and walking around, and everybody's looking at you, and I know they know who I am, but still you kind of hope people don't know who you are. I don't remember any music. I don't remember anything. I just remember how fun it was. And so I continued to do it. My parents allowed it into my teens. And so I talked maybe a couple of my friends, or my dad would dress up and we would go masquerade, and then it was fun. It was just, I guess maybe, and I've like sat as audience in masquerade and before then, of course, and there would be, sometimes you'd be really scared, just the scary looking costume, just almost violent, you know, because these people that were dressed up scary and kids screaming and running under benches and they're chasing them, and it was exciting. And it's like shifted now. It's not the same as it was, but I feel like it's still important. It's still having an audience that's looking forward to something and being in a position to be able to make them happy, to make people happy. Or yes, I guess maybe sometimes a crying kid or two is okay. And it's not easy. It's never been ever easy. Every year that I've done it, it's a challenge. But when you do it and you walk in there, just the feeling of having to change your form so you try not to be recognized by how you walk. I think an ultimate goal for a really top-notch masquerade is to go in and leave with no one knowing who that person is. That's fun. So I hope masquerade continues for sure. And then there's Askinuqtan. Askinuqtan, where we go around and shake a pot and beg at people's doors. There's one time that I went again, I think my brother Tim and then Laura, and I don't remember, maybe it was Thomas as well. We went, usually wait till it's dark. It's more fun when it's dark. And we were all covered with our blankets and had our pots, and there was this new teacher that year that came to work here, and Timon was like, let's go to her house. And so we went up the steps and we knocked on the door, and she opens the door and she's like, does your mom wear combat boots? I don't know why she said that, but she did. And we're like standing there. You can't do anything. You just keep shaking your pot. And she says, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Am I supposed to take something? And she reaches her hand and we pull our pots away. And she goes, okay, I'm not supposed to take something. Am I supposed to give you something? So we're like shaking our pots and nodding our head. She's like, okay, hold on a second. So she walks away from the door, leaves it open a little bit, and we're waiting. We're waiting. What's she doing? What's going on? What's happening? Shaking her pots. And then she comes back and throws peeled carrots in our pots. She had actually taken the time to go into her kitchen and peel 4 carrots and then put them in our pot. That was fun. In the earlier times that I went Askinuqtan, you got like, you might get canned food. Yeah, some people might give you a can of beer, or a potato. And then over time, it shifted, you know, by the 80s to candy. Maybe people got leftover Christmas candy. Maybe it was hard Halloween candy. But yeah, you like to go to, sometimes there might be a fry bread. So there was those earlier times, you would get like a good good food. So now, I think with where I am at in 2020s, I feel a little bit concerned about our community. If I look back, I really am grateful for what I experienced, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. Growing up here, and not just growing up in my childhood, but in my adult years, I feel like I hope I engaged. Earlier I said I didn't really engage much in whatever's happening economically with the shift from... I never really was employed in anything with the fur industry. My friends were, my peers were, but I wasn't. I never really was employed in any way in the fisheries arena. If I look back, I wished I could have paid more attention to what was going on during those times. I do remember the fun things of like the harbor being developed, and there were celebrations after celebration, like a breaking of or blessing because of the breakwater being built, or blessing because a dock was built, and a blessing with the small boat harbor. And the thing that I remember about that is people coming together. That for me is important. And looking back, the fact that we got together so many times is what I'm grateful for. My concern now is there's less of that. There's less community getting together, and there's a lot more isolating of individuals isolating themselves. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I am glad that I grew up with all the community events and community gatherings. Today, being concerned about the state of the sea around us, and pondering upon not being stronger than nature. That nature, I feel, will do what it has to do, and it'll bounce back with or without us. And we just have to trust in it. We have to engage in it with ceremony. We have to constantly ask of it, not for financial reasons, but to feed us directly, to give us what we would need to create for ourselves directly, but not to necessarily get rich off of it. But I feel like we still need to continuously engage and eat from the sea, eat from the land, in order for it to stay alive. And that kind of goes back to my dad telling me that if you want to understand something, then you should eat it. And so that's like something that's been an important message that sometimes I forget, but hopefully I go forward and keep it in mind. If there was anything I would say right now about living a happy, successful life, is to remember it's not going to like be 100% happy, but I do know that walking into things that are a little fearful. In fact, everything that I've walked into, that I've succeeded at, most times I walked into it with fear, and I don't know, maybe fear of failure, fear of judgment. But just kept walking, keep going into it, and at the other end, whether you succeeded with what you wanted to or thought you wanted to achieve, it's not going to look exactly how it was when you started. At the other end, it's completely different, but usually at that other end, you gain more than you bargained for. But you got to do it. It's just, can't be afraid of the work, can't be afraid of the failure, and just do it. Yeah. Yeah. Sanako.